Welcome to Today on Broadway for Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway Stars James Marino.
James, today is 4/11, so considering you didn't tell me what you wanted to talk about at the beginning of the show, I'm just going to turn the floor over to you, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you. This is my global apology for mislinking the episode on Monday.
I got
lots of emails, texts, phone calls. People actually gave me credit for a hoax of replaying the Groundhog Day podcast.
I thought that's what you were doing. Yes, absolutely. 100%. We talked about it ahead of time.
Yeah. That's, I'm glad everybody got that joke. That's cool. But if you were to go back and you must listen to yesterday's show, which I highly recommend, we had some of our good material in there. Delete. Okay. Mute yourself, damn it. So if you must listen to yesterday's show to hear what we had to say about the news, delete the podcast that you had, the episode from yesterday, and then try to download it again. It should straighten itself out, and I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, I woke up to a couple tweets like, what's going on? I was on my way out to the gym, and so I tweeted to you, and you had it fixed by the time I got on the treadmill, so I appreciate
that. Nice. Nice. You threw that in there. That's excellent. You know, yeah, it was, I was working on whatsplayingonbroadway.com at the time, so anyway, .com.
Nice.
Nice. All right. So the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for Drama was announced, as well as many other publishers, but we'll talk about the drama.
Yes, absolutely. Yesterday, the 2017 Pulitzer Prizes were announced, and in addition to the Washington Post columnist who investigated candidate Trump's taxes and the New York Times team that reported on Russia hacking the election, as well as the owner of a tiny Iowa twice-weekly paper who wrote about corruption in the state's agricultural industry, was the prize for drama, which this year went to Lynn Nottage for her play Sweat, which can currently be seen on Broadway. This is Nottage's second Pulitzer Prize following her 2009 win for her play Ruined. This marks the first time that a woman has won two Pulitzers in this category in the award's nearly 100-year history. Nottage also joins August Wilson as the only two playwrights of color to win multiple awards. Nottage also will receive a $15,000 cash prize. This year's finalists also announced today included a 24-decade history of popular music by Taylor Mack and The Wolves by Sarah Dillap. Sweat is currently playing at Studio 54 on Broadway. James, I think, as you said, when it was off Broadway, because this is technically the debut performance happened in 2016, it was off Broadway, but you raved about how important this was of kind of chronicling a part of the American life that is not often seen on either stages or screens. So this seems like a very well-deserved award for Nottage.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed the show, and we talked about it at the time, and it has since moved to Broadway. I think it's really important that folks see this show. And I'm glad that the Pulitzers recognize this. I'm surprised, Matt, you didn't include Hilton Ahls from The New Yorker.
I actually have that up right here. I was going to add it in. Hilton Ahls of The New Yorker won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism for bold and original reviews that strove to put stage dramas within a real-world cultural context, particularly the shifting landscape of gender, sexuality, and race. The finalists in the criticism category were Laura Riley of the Tampa Bay Times, down in my neck of the woods, and Ty Burr of the Boston Globe. So a little overlap there. There were some other great ones in there as well. Peggy Noonan won for the Wall Street Journal for commentary. One of my personal favorites in the see if I can get the exact category correct, is It's Just Fiction. Yeah, it was Colson Whitehead for The Underground Railroad, which is a fantastic book if people haven't read it. So congratulations to everybody who won a Pulitzer Prize. That is definitely in the lead paragraph, if not sentence, of your obit whenever you shuffle off this mortal coil.
So the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, do you think that is something that is a candidate? You read it to be adapted for the stage?
It could be. It's part, allegory and a mythology that kind of weaves a really interesting tale of it's called the Underground Railroad, but it takes that a little more literally than what we normally know the Underground Railroad to be in historical context. I've read three or four books by Colson Whitehead, and he's generally way too smart for me to understand, but I always enjoy him nonetheless. So it who knows, that could be a good play someday. I think it would definitely play better as a play than a movie, probably just because of the kind of high-minded intellectualism with it.
Okay, so let's move on to last week's Broadway grosses.
Yeah, in adding two shows to the boards last week, Broadway is now at its current capacity at 40 shows playing since the Helen Hayes Theater is currently under renovations. That resulted in the highest grossing week of the year following the one that ended on New Year's Day. Technically, that's a 2017 year, and since it was the week between Christmas and New Year's, it was like $11 million higher than last week. But nonetheless, last week's grosses came in at $35,186,717, with Hamilton leading the way just about $21,000 short of the $3 million mark. Next on the list was The Lion King, which had its best week of the year since the first full week of 2017. Simba and Crew grossed $2,073,000. $208. Sorry, I had to read my own typo there. Followed impressively by Bette Midler and Hello Dolly at $1,939,035 in just seven performances. Wicked was next, followed by Aladdin, School of Rock, The Book of Mormon, Waitress, Dear Evan Hansen, Sunday in the Park with George, Sunset Boulevard, and The Phantom of the Opera. Waitress, which I just mentioned, saw a nice Sarah Bareilles fueled bump in her first full week, increasing over $184,000, making it the biggest non-preview, you know, moving up in a total number of performances, mover of the week. Speaking of shows and previews, despite ungodly negative word of mouth, the worst I've heard since Spider-Man, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was less than $48,000 away from breaking $1 million in just six performances last week, while Anastasia was at $922,021 in just seven previews. War Paint, which as you know opened last week and had all those free tickets to give away, was also north of $900,000, while Groundhog Day is struggling a little bit despite your little hoax you played with the episode yesterday. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that'll be on next week's.
They'll boost next week's grosses, yeah.
Absolutely. But it came in at $621,000 over a full eight-show preview week. And then moving from two to six performances, Bandstand clocked in at just under $377,000, which isn't the start you probably want with so many bigger profile shows getting going as well. But that show is still early in previews with plenty of times for word of mouth to increase things. However, the one preview that, despite it being early, I am still incredibly concerned about is A Doll's House Part 2. The show, in its first week of eight performances, and actually it's only second week of previews, grossed only $106,000. That's nothing. Despite a fantastic cast and phenomenal early reports from preview audiences, there has been little to no marketing or PR done for this show, which, James, well, let's take a break here because there's a few more grosses I want to get to, but this is really odd, not only for the fact that it's got a great cast, but it's a Scott Rudin show, like, and it's getting great word of mouth. Like, I just really don't understand what's going on with The Doll's House Part 2.
Well, I have not seen many, if any, media buys on it. I don't see it anywhere.
I can speak for Broadway World. It's part of a larger SRP buy that happens occasionally on our site, but I haven't seen it anywhere else. They have almost no social media footprint at all. So I don't, and I mean, I'm not in New York, so I don't know if there's something else up there on TV or radio or subways or something.
I don't see anything. I'm looking at O&M is their DKC O&M is their press rep. I am looking at my press releases from them right now. I have a January press release, a February press release, a March press release, a second March press release, and that's it. I don't even have an April press release. Yeah. We're at April 10th. I don't know what's going on there. Yeah, certainly maybe they're just holding it all back until they're ready to make some sort of grand entrance down a staircase. I don't know.
Well, this, you know, presumably by the great word of mouth and the great people involved with the show, very well could be one that gets a huge bump with awards, because it'll be eligible for not only the Tonys, but drama desks as well. So maybe they're trying to say, wait, let's hold back all the money we have for advertising and marketing until we have something to hang our hats on, because this is a show that people don't really know about, even though they know the name of Doll's House. But that's, from what I understand, the original Henrik Ibsen Doll's House is much different than the Lucas Hanatz Doll's House Part 2 in terms of the tone of the show. So maybe they're just waiting to do a huge media blitz and advertising blitz when they have some award nominations to crow about. But we'll see, because I'm hearing great things, but seeing very little of anything.
We have not actually given the listeners, if they don't know A Doll's House Part 2, given you any details. Laurie Metcalf, Chris Cooper, Jane Howdy Shell, Condola Rashad, Sam Gold, produced Scott Rudin, Barry Diller, John Gore Organization. John Gore Organization is the organization that owns Broadway Across America and Broadway.com. The Ambassador Theater Group.
Not familiar.
No, they're small. They're a tiny organization. Universal Stage Productions, so Universal Pictures. I mean, this is major. At the John Golden, it's first preview March 30th, opening date April 27th. So we still have 17 days, 18 days, 16 days. My math is backwards. And it's a limited run scheduled through July 23rd. So odd. And interesting, Scott Rudin is producing and the Ambassador Theater Group. Didn't they just have a little tiff in yesterday's show?
They did. Let's be honest. I mean, Rudin has tiffs with quite a few people. We just mentioned a Groundhog Day, where, if you remember, Scott Rudin from last year was one of the producers of the West End debut of that show, and then bailed out when things weren't going creatively the way he wanted. But that's neither here nor there. A Doll's House Part 2, apparently a great show from word of mouth, but it's not doing so well, and I'm a little concerned about it making it to that July closing date. But we'll get back to that. I'm sure there's plenty of time to talk about that. Let's finish up other shows that aren't going to make their original closing date. Significant Other, which, as we talked about previously, I think on yesterday's show, will close a week from this coming Sunday, was next up on the rung above A Doll's House Part 2 on the grosses ladder with just $129,000. And the recently announced Pulitzer Prize winner, Sweat, was at nearly $304,000. But I wonder what, if any, impact yesterday's prize announcement will have on the show's bottom line. And in case you were a glutton for punishment and you were wondering, In Transit pulled into the station at almost $195,000 last week. Now, James, despite this one being, a struggler at the box office from nearly the word go, to their credit, they are out there doing some media buys. They're doing some contests. They're doing some social media stuff. They're doing some original videos. In Transit is trying to, restart that train, for lack of a better metaphor, where A Doll's House doesn't really seem to have been doing much of anything yet.
So I just want to flip back temporarily for a second back to the first story about the Pulitzers, because we had mentioned in there that one of the finalists for the Pulitzers was The Wolves by Sarah Dillap. And in This Week on Broadway on Sunday, we talked with Tedra Milan, who starred in The Wolves and was a timeout pick for they did a profile on her as sort of a rising star, someone to watch. So it's interesting that both the play got recognized and Time Out had picked out Tedra, who's right now on Broadway in Present Laughter. So let's move forward into the next thing, which is the show and casting news.
Yeah, let's start off with yesterday, the St. Louis Muni Theater announced additional star casting for its 99th season. James, you'll remember a week or so ago, they announced a huge swath of big name stars that were going to be joining their fantastic performances this summer. I'm just going to run through some of the ones that they added. As I'm sure you all know, we will have the full additional casting that was announced yesterday in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. In the June 12th through 18th production of Jesus Christ Superstar, star. The one and only Christopher Sieber will be playing King Herod, and Michael Kilgore will be playing Annas. They joined the previously announced Bryce Rhynas as Jesus, Constantine Maroulis as Judas, Sierra Renee as Mary Magdalene, and Ben Davis as Pontius Pilate. Then Disney's The Little Mermaid from June 20th through 29th will welcome Jason Gotay as Prince Eric. He'll be joining Emma Degerstead as Ariel, Emily Skinner as Ursula, and Jerry Dixon as King Triton. A funny thing happened on the way to the forum from July 5th through the 11th. We'll now welcome Mark Lynn Baker as Cynix and David Joseph Berg as Lycus. They joined the previously announced Jordan Gelber as Pseudolus, John Tartaglia as Hysterium, and Ali Ewald as Philia. Interestingly, James, in the 1996 Broadway revival of Forum, Cousin Larry himself, Mark Lynn Baker, played Hysterium.
I was so just going to say that, yeah.
Yeah, so he's returning to the world of Sondheim and classic Roman comedy. And All Shook Up, which will be playing the Muni from the 13th through 19th of July. Felicia Finley will be joining the previously announced Carolyn Bowman. And then here's the one that's really interesting, James. A guy that I think you and I have more than expressed our moderately creepy affection for, Mark Kudish, will be playing J.J. Brown in The Unsinkable Molly Brown from July 21st through 27th, joining the previously announced Beth Malone, Paolo Montalban, and Whitney Basher. Kathleen Marshall will direct and choreograph this show, which is very heavily rumored to have Broadway intentions, so getting Kudish on board for something like that is never a bad thing. Then the final show of the season will be Newsies, which will run from the 7th through the 13th. Teray Campbell will be joining the production as Meta Larkin. Daniel Quadrino will be playing Crutchy. Spencer Davis Milford will be playing Davy, and Gabriel Citron will play Les. They joined the previously announced Jay Armstrong Johnson as Jack, Tessa Grady as Catherine, and Jeff McCarthy as Pulitzer. Generally, I just kind of ran through the names I knew. I don't know many of these names in this. I know Teray Campbell has played Meta Larkin before. I don't know some of these other names, but I know the Fanzies do, so I wanted to get those in there. It's also worth noting, Fanzies, that yesterday Disney Theatrical Productions announced that the filmed version of Newsies that we all saw on the big screen last month, or actually in February, it's been more than a month now, will be available for digital download, so you can keep it on your computer forever and ever, amen, beginning on May 23rd. Pre-orders are available now. And finally, the Muni also announced a big chunk of the cast for A Chorus Line, which will run from July 29th through August 4th. If you want to look at that current casting list, there will be additional casting still to be announced later. As I said earlier, head over to the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com.
All right. Once on this island, embarks on a Haiti casting search.
Yeah, James, we talked about this when it was announced. The producers of the, I guess, upcoming Broadway revival of Once on This Island, led by the one and only Ken Davenport, are going on a not just national search to find their lead actress, but they are actually going to Haiti, where the show is set. Now, this isn't new. We knew that this was going to happen on the 7th and 8th of April. The production team met with the Ministry of Culture and Communications and the director of the National Theater in Haiti. But James, what I didn't realize, and maybe this has been talked about, and maybe I just completely missed it, but we know that Michael Arden is going to be the director of this production. But what I didn't know is that one Nikki M. James will be the assistant director. Of course, a Tony Award winner for her performance in The Book of Mormon, Nikki M. James and Michael Arden, I believe, are both California kids and I think have a long relationship. I've seen them on social media together, you know, with pictures and communicating and stuff over the years. I hadn't realized that. So if that's something that people knew, I apologize, but I didn't know, and that kind of excited me because I'm a huge Nikki M. James fan. So we'll see what they do, if they find anybody in Port-au-Prince to play Timon. It's still, if nothing else, it's a nice little, attention grab by Ken Davenport, which he does extremely well. Finally,
let me interrupt you for a second. I wonder how much they thought about going to Port-au-Prince, Haiti, to look for casting. I mean, this is a country who is devastated, still devastated
by the earthquake.
I really wonder if they thought this through. I mean,
there's a lot of things that I think you and I wonder if Ken Davenport thinks through. But I will say this. this show is very much about the haves and the have-nots on this tiny island and the devastation of natural disasters. So I don't think it's actually necessarily a bad thing for the creative team, especially the director and the assistant director, obviously, and I'm not sure if other members of the creative team went as well, but if nothing else, to kind of see that firsthand. Now, obviously, the modern-day Port-au-Prince and Haiti as a whole is much different than that represented in Once on This Island, but it can give some pretty important background for them, if nothing else, if nothing, you know, actually comes of their casting search. You know, they might be getting something out of that that they can add into this kind of rethought production that, you know, is going to be using some a little more authentic percussion, I guess, is the best way to describe it. So I hope that this isn't just kind of a ploy to get some attention, and they maybe can get something positive out of that. With people like Michael Arden and Nicky M. James, I completely have faith that they're doing this for the right reasons and will get something out of it. Other people involved with the production, I'm not so sure. So, you know.
Well, I think that they should hire you as their press rep. That was an excellent answer.
Hey, man, I do what I can. Off the top of my head, I'm just freestyling off my dome. I'm like Lin-Manuel Miranda sitting here in my home.
Hey, did you see that picture of Lin-Manuel from London at the Olivier's yesterday that the curtain call guy sent over?
I did, yeah. There is a great tweet. In fact, as I'm doing this now, let's see if I can find it here. I will retweet it from both mine and Broadway Radio's account. There's a picture of our friend John Schwab from the Curtain Call over in London. They're the guys who have the book of all the fantastic backstage shots over in London. It's actually a picture with Sonia Friedman, the great producer, the fantastic playwright Tom Stoppard, and some guy named Lin-Manuel Miranda. We'll go ahead and retweet that from our account, so check that out. And James, as you know, John Schwab is filming a movie in Boston, and you and or I might get a chance to see him while he's in the States. So
that playing baseball in Fenway Park, filming a movie.
Yeah. That doesn't suck.
That's like a great Venn diagram. We haven't mentioned Venn diagrams in a while.
Yeah. No, it's been a while.
All right. So the attack of the Elvis impersonators announces the off-Broadway cast. Are these folks that are used to be in Honeymoon in Vegas?
No, completely different group of Elvis impersonators, James. Okay. yesterday, producer Lawrence Rossner announced the casting creative team from the new musical Attack of the Elvis Impersonators, which features a book, music, and lyrics by Laurie Lazarus. It'll be directed by Broadway veteran Don Stevenson and choreographed by Melissa Zaremba. The performances will begin on June 1st at the Lion Theater at Theater Row, with an opening night set for Thursday, June 15th. The cast will feature Eric Sesoto, along with Ashley Spencer of Rock of Ages and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Greasier, the One That I Want fame, which is where I know her. She's a Buckeye. Go Bucks. It'll also feature Curtis Wiley and a whole bunch of other folks. We will have the cast complete list in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com. The show is described thusly: when the soul of Elvis returns to Earth... I'm in already, James. I've read 8 words and I'm in. When the soul of Elvis returns to Earth and inhabits the body of the most famous rock star in history, he instructs his disciples that to bring peace to the planet, we all must unite as one. And to do that, the entire human race must impersonate Elvis, obviously, satirizing everything from idol worship to people who have experienced actual healing by their faith in Elvis. Attack of the Elvis Impersonators will make you howl like a hound dog as it converts you to I stole their joke, as it converts you to Hound Dog, the new religion of peace. I am in love with this show just by their one paragraph show description.
Oh, that's awesome. It sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. All right. So next up, award show news. It's that time. It's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's the most wonderful time of the year because by the time we get to these award show things, James, you've gone through the gauntlet of having to see everything and you can kind of relax a little bit. But yesterday, the American Theater Wing and the Village Voice announced that the 62nd annual Obie Awards will be held on Monday, May 22nd at Webster Hall. And Obie and Screen Actors Guild award-winning actress Leah Delaria will return as host for the third consecutive year. Tickets are now available at obieawards.com. Also, yesterday, it was announced At the Drama League announced that Tony winners Bettina Miller and B.B. Newworth, both doing some pretty fossy moves and some Tony wins there, will announce the 2017 Drama League nominees. That will happen on April 19th at 11 a.m. It will be streamed online from Sardi's. I know we'll be streaming it at Broadway World, and I'm sure you can find it other places as well. James, we're getting to almost mid-April, which means that we are just about 2 months away from the actual Tony Awards themselves. Still without a host. TikTok. I wonder what that's all about.
Well, did you see Charles McNulty's article in the LA Times?
Yes, you sent it over. I took a look at it. It has something to do with somebody who's been boning up on a lot of Broadway here lately. The article itself posits that perhaps someone named Hillary Rodham Clinton might be a good candidate to be a part of the Tonys this year, huh?
Yeah, I mean, at least invite her to the Tonys. She seems to be popping up at a lot of Broadway shows, and I heard an inside rumor that she thought that she was on track to get the Times second slot reviewer position, but that didn't quite work out. She won the popular vote, but anyway.
She's a woman, so that slot was never going to go to her.
Oh, hopefully things will change. But, you know, having the Clintons involved in the Tony Awards, let's link to the Charles McNulty article from the LA Times.
I've got it here.
And folks can read it for themselves. I'd really love it if Hillary and Bill took my seat at the Tonys. That would be great. I don't know if both of them fit into one seat, but assuming I had two.
Sit on it. Yeah. On the wall, yeah.
All right. Tony and Olivier Award correlation.
Yes, this is something, James, that you and I kind of talked about yesterday as we discussed the Olivier winners and it being a lot more about original London shows that we know are going to be moving to Broadway. And this is on that same line. Christopher D. Shea of the New York Times did an article kind of looking at the trajectory of shows that have won Tonys and then gone to London or have won Olivier's and gone to New York. Everything from The Beauty Queen of Lanon to The Producers to War Horse, things that did incredibly well in one of those areas and then did not. Also discusses Carolina Change, The Pillow Man, Matilda, King Charles III. It's just kind of a great thing. It's not, you know, super analytical. Like we said yesterday, we don't really understand or even know if there's a rationale for what does well in London and doesn't in New York or vice versa. But it is kind of cool to look at the kinds of shows that have done well in one of the two major theatrical centers of the world, but not the other. So we'll link to that. And it's really cool to kind of take a look down memory lane as to what shows have been successful in one of the two venues and not the other.
Hey, one of the shows last week or the week before that I did by myself, there was an article from Cranes New York that talked about the correlation between the New York Times reviewing a play off Broadway and mm-hmm. back on if it transferred on Broadway, and how the New York Times tends to love them off Broadway and then slam them when they got on Broadway, and much to the chagrin of Broadway producers. And it's not like it's always a different reviewer. It seems to be that Mr. Brantley likes things when they're mm-hmm. downtown, and then when they get into Midtown, seemingly the same production. I think it was on the heels of the review of Sweat.
Well, and it's interesting to me that that comes from Cranes New York, which is not exactly a normal theatrical or entertainment publication. That's more, correct me if I'm wrong, more of kind of like a real estate and architecture publication, correct?
Cranes business. It's a business publication.
But what's interesting about that to me is that, James, it just, you know, there are shows that will work both in small off-Broadway houses as well as larger Broadway houses. But there are some that really only play well in one of those two venues. And I think it's not always an obvious, you know, delineation between what will work well off-Broadway and on-Broadway. I think there are some things that kind of blur those lines and are surprise hits. Like, I think I know a lot of people that did not expect The Great Comet of 1812 to do as well in a big tent as it did in a big Broadway theater. But that's, you know, credit to the cast and creative team and everybody over there that made that happen. But shows like Sweat, which are more intimate character dramas, kind of, it just makes sense that they work better off Broadway than they do on Broadway. And it takes a really special show and a really special creative team to make that transition and transfer work smoothly.
I think that, you know, we've probably seen this in Significant Other and probably In Transit as well, when In Transit probably worked really well in a small venue, whether it be a some sort of rehearsal hall or some sort of presentation.
Yeah, it had an off-Broadway run, but I think it was like in 2007 or 2008. So I believe it was a New York Times critics pick at that point, too. But a lot of time passes between that, and even though Circle in the Square is not exactly a huge Broadway house, it's still bigger than whatever off-Broadway house they were in before.
I'm very concerned about the transfer of Oslo from downstairs to upstairs at Lincoln Center Theater because I loved Oslo when I saw it, technically off-Broadway in the downstairs portion of the Mitzi Newhouse at Lincoln
Center.
Going
up to the Vivian Beaumont
now. It's going up to the Vivian Beaumont, and much of Oslo is about small, intimate conversations, and I wonder if it's going to transfer well into the large space upstairs. So I'm concerned about that. I love the show, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. All right, so Waitress releases a Sarah Bareilles highlights.
Yeah, I just wanted to close the show out with this because it brought me in probably an inappropriate amount of joy to see these very short highlights. Not inappropriate like that. It was just a large amount of joy to see Sarah Bareilles performing in the show she wrote. I think she is an incredibly talented and warm and wonderful star, whether it's pop music or TV competition show hosting or now Broadway theater. I'm a huge Sarah Bareilles fan, and to see her in this role and just short snippets like you normally see in the highlight B-roll that Broadway sites get. But it was a lot of fun, and I'm so jealous of the folks who are getting to see her on Broadway for these 10 weeks. And as we talked about before, what an incredibly smart way to bridge the gap during the awards season and opening season when all the other shows are gaining attention that Waitress had previously gotten, to replace a beloved Tony winner like Jesse Mueller with the show's incredibly popular pop music star composer like Sarah Bareilles. I think Waitress has done itself a huge, huge service by doing this, and then it'll bridge the gap into summer when somebody replaces Sarah Bareilles, and will probably continue to do super well over at the Brooks Atkinson. So check out those highlights. I loved it. I may or may not have gotten a little teary-eyed, but I'm not confirming nor denying.
Do you think that maybe we'll see Sarah Bareilles do a song on the Tony Awards?
I don't know. It's a little odd. She did perform on the Tonys last year, if you remember, and I was kind of annoyed by it until I realized that it was to cover a Jesse Mueller costume change or pregnancy bump change. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would be surprised. I guess I laughed because I will absolutely guarantee she will perform in some way or another. I don't know if it'll be performing a song from Waitress or not, but I would be shocked if she is not featured fairly heavily in this summer's Tony Awards.
All right, why don't you get us out of here?
All right, thanks for listening to Today on Broadway. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio, and you can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt, and subscribe to Something Got Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play.
Oh, holy moly, 30-plus minutes. I'm so sorry.
Oh, yeah, long one.
My name is James Marino from BroadwayRadio.com, BroadwayStars.com. No jokes for me here. It's Tuesday. We'll see you tomorrow.